All right, welcome back, everyone. It's a beautiful summer. I hope you're enjoying your summer. I'm doing a follow-up conversation for this podcast with my friend Josh Reebok, who is a storyteller, poet, author of My Generation and Heroes and Monsters, and just somebody who's invested a lot in the schools that I've been at and shares a lot of his heart and his life with me and with my community. But Josh, the last podcast we did, maybe around December, I've gotten some incredible conversations that have come out of that. And one of the questions I wanted to ask you as a follow-up to that before we get into some of the questions I had even for this podcast is, when you think about creativity, I'm sure you hear often after you speak or often after you share, oh, you're really talented. But what part of creativity, and this came up in conversation, what parts of the creative process are talent, hard work, just the anguish of it all, and then just some, maybe just some lightning in a bottle luck?
Yeah, wouldn't it be great if I could say, well, with me, it's all talent, Eric. Yeah, that would be just a grand lie to tell. First of all, thanks for having me back, man. This is great. I think that's hard to answer, and in the sense that it's like sort of I find it to be a cocktail that almost becomes pointless to try to parse out. Because a lot of times I don't know if it's hard work or if it's just luck, or if an idea is something that's just very serendipitous. It just kind of comes from a conversation, you may have had earlier that day or 2 weeks prior. But having said all of that, I am very much an advocate for the idea that character has to be honed just like a craft does. And I think maybe nowhere does that show up more in terms of creativity than in the need to do what you just said, and that's work hard. Oftentimes I find, particularly in a long-term project, if I'm toward the middle to back half of finishing a book, or even when I'm creating a stage presentation, I find that at some point it becomes a much greater test of endurance than it does talent. Talent, seems like that's something that is kind of a dime a dozen. But it seems like the more difficult part is to continually apply that talent to a task or to an endeavor. It seems like that's where the magic really starts to happen. I mean, I remember reading something. I think it's Albert Einstein, and of course we don't believe him because we think of him as having this sort of otherworldly intellect. But he said, genius is just sticking with a problem longer. And I in my own average Joe sense resonate with that very much. In a creative sense, that oftentimes it's not a matter of if someone's talent can get themselves through a creative problem. It's just if they're going to stick with the problem long enough to work their way through it. And so that to me is often the hardest test. And I think that's probably where I need to grow most, is just in my sense of creative endurance to keep going. When it feels like the more comfortable thing to do is just sort of wave the artistic white flag and go on my way and try something else.
And that's that helps me, and it helps, I think, as people think about this, because, we consistently think of, quality and all of this as talent-based, and there is, that's a starting point. But then the endurance to continue that work through.
Yeah, well, and I would even say, like, I mean, when we're talking about talent, like, a lot of times, I don't know how this is for you, but that's such like an amoebic term. I'm like, what are we actually like talking about? Like, when I say I see a talented you know, athlete. I'm usually, for me, when I say that, I tend to be, I think I'm referring to a certain skill set or musculature that was sort of inherent to who they are. And then the skill is about how you work towards honing that talent, I suppose. But when it comes to creativity, it's like, well, are we talking about people who have good ideas? Are we talking about people who just have an innate sense for how to sweep a brush across a canvas, or that know that there needs to be more red in that corner? For someone that just sort of has this internal metronome, if they're a musician, like, I'm not always sure what we're, even in my own life, I'm not always sure when I'm referring to an artist that has talent, what I even mean. And so for me, I guess the people that I look to, I want to believe that they're talented, but I think I'm learning more and more, these are people that, while talented, what gets whatever is in them out is this sort of like, I don't know, maybe this is overshooting it, but it's almost like they're obsessed. It's a certain, call it a passion, call it an obsession, but it's to not let whatever they have been given sort of wither on the vine. And that I think is oftentimes what separates, you know, not just one athlete from another, but separates artists one from another.
You use that term, you know, obsession or obsessiveness, and I think that's pretty accurate. But in that sense, too, like culture or people or, you know, even parents. I was blessed to have a father who was an artist, so I didn't have to necessarily deal with this, but you know, I've seen it with students for many years. Is it's, you know, that obsession or that passion is not practical. And so, you know, what would be your encouragement to somebody who just kind of keeps hitting, you know, that brick wall, whatever it might be, you know, and how they just kind of keep going forward and keep continuing? Because endurance is, there is that idea of, there is just a place for exhaustion in that. And that through that exhaustion or through that difficulty, you know, to the other side. I mean, what would be your piece of encouragement to somebody who's kind of in that place of like, you know, I'm almost done?
Yeah. Well, I have certainly been in that place. I feel like maybe in a fleeting sense, I'm there pretty frequently where I just, man, I think I have to fight against a certain danger that I have. And the danger is that a lot of times what I want, maybe not in the core of who I am, but in response to the difficulty of becoming who I want to be in my core, is I just want my life to be easy. I just want it to be comfortable. I don't want to have to endure. I want my talent to be so much, or my ability to be so much, that I don't ever have to have it hard along the way. And so I have to first, I think, be aware of that while I want that, I don't think deep down for me that is perpetually satisfying. Secondly, what comes to mind is, for me, when I say endurance, there tends to be, I think, in endurance, the notion that perpetually going, right? And that's not what I mean. Part of it at times, but maybe what I mean more is creating patterns that allow for an enduring pursuit. And to me, that doesn't always mean sitting at my laptop and typing more. That doesn't always mean, you know, reading more. Sometimes creating patterns for endurance means, for me, you know, watching the World Cup and going on vacation and sipping coffee or watching some stupid movie that just lets my mind disconnect, or having great conversations that have nothing to do with my zest for my craft. And so it's not just endure, as in like, don't stop. To me, while in times it's part that, it's about, asking, what do I have to do to create patterns, to create an architecture in my life that allows me to do this for the long haul, so that, to your point, Eric, I don't reach these patterns of exhaustion or burnout, or where I just want to throw up my hands and walk away.
That's it's really interesting to think about that, you know, from that sense of even that first question of what is the, and you use the term cocktail, and you use that term cocktail, and then we kind of go to, you know, the architecture of life, and how do we allow that, you know, cocktail to kind of come together, but at the same time, you know, in some ways craft and be purposeful about allowing our lives to, you know, kind of mesh and merge with the experience of life.
Yeah. And there, and to me, even that like, it's even for me, it's having a certain experience in my life and a certain, just the act of being present in my life. A lot of times it almost seems counterintuitive, but it's being present in my life away from work oftentimes is the very thing that then allows me to endure in my work. And as opposed to this notion of, you know, I have to stay in my work in order for my work to move forward. Sometimes that's the very thing preventing it from doing so. And sometimes what I really need is to develop in other areas of my life, not necessarily other crafts, but I might just need to develop as a human being or a husband or a friend or a person who likes walks with my dog, so that when I show up to be in an attempt to create something, I actually am bringing something to that exercise, and not just kind of the same skeletonized version of me that I've become by not stepping away.
So let me transition then a little bit from that, because you and I have talked quite a bit about, and it was really you sharing with me a speech, you know, about a speech that you gave, or, you know, a conversation that you had with some other artists. And you were talking about the idea of wholesomeness and holiness within the creative process and within the production side of things, whether it be in storytelling, books, you know, movies or film. Like, you know, even in this creative process and even in this life stuff, and we want our you know, our creativity to reflect the honesty in some ways of life, but then the hopefulness as well as the pain of life. Like, how have you distinguished for other people this idea of wholesomeness versus holiness?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how well I've done that for anybody else, but I'm trying to frame it for me. And part of the reason is Eric, as you know, I grew up in a, and I don't use this word negatively, though sometimes it carries that connotation, but I grew up in a pretty religious culture, in the sense that there was a definition for me clearly, about sort of what the rhythms of life ought to be and what the values of life ought to be. And as I grew up and growing out of that, especially as I leveraged more and more of my life toward language and writing and oral storytelling and poetry and whatnot, those things I found started to feel a really strong friction between a sense of my worldview and the things I wanted to make. And for a long time, I didn't even have the ability to put a finger on what was causing the friction. And it all, I suppose, came to a point where I had the first conversation. I was in Chicago. Kristen and I think we're living in Austin or Charleston at the time. And I was in a coffee shop and I was working on a project, and I had this immense sense of guilt and shame in me about what I was making, about the story I was writing. And while I was there at this coffee shop, I met with a friend, and he was kind enough to lend me an open ear and certainly an open heart. And I just started talking. And essentially what I started saying to him was, with my work, I often gravitate towards, you know, for lack of better terms, a certain darkness. I enjoy exploring loneliness and pain and grief. And whenever is necessary, in order to tell a story or to convey something as best as possible, I'll use unsettling imagery. I'll use violence. I mean, I have to do whatever is most effective to communicate this story. And I expressed to my friend that a lot of the books and the film and the television that inspire me are along that similar end of the spectrum. And so finally, I asked my friend this question. And I think it was the first time I'd said it out loud. My question was, how do I reconcile that with this idea of being and pursuing holiness? Like, are those two things, some of my creative inclinations, are they in conflict with this idea of being and pursuing holiness? And so my friend is sitting there and he says, Josh, can I tell you a story? Which, of course, I'm never going to say no to that. And so he says, once there were two sisters, and neither were married and neither had children. And because of culture's arcane and largely misogynistic definition of femininity, these two sisters were often left to feel inadequate. They were marginalized at times. They were even in society humiliated. They're lonely. They're hurting. And so my friend goes on. He says, one night, these two sisters, they formed a plan. And following a family dinner with their father, they sat around the fireplace. They opened a bottle of wine. They provided him with a glass and then another and another and another until he was drunk. So now when his senses were too dulled to think, the sisters led him up the staircase and into his room where either sister slept with them, both becoming pregnant. So I'm sitting in this coffee shop and my friend is telling me the story. And he looks at me and he said, Josh, this story is very, very disturbing. It's very heartbreaking. It's incredibly dark. And then he has this pause and he says, and it's also in the Old Testament. He says, it's in the book of Genesis. He says, and this story of Lot and his daughters contributes something significant and something meaningful to what a lot of people call the Holy Bible. And so this conversation with my friend helped me frame a lot of what was sort of causing internal conflict in my own processes. And the question was, is holy the same as wholesome? Are they the same thing? And if at times the two diverge, which one do I pursue? And so that kind of led me down this rabbit hole of so many questions. It's like, through which lens, holy or wholesome, am I creating? Which is really my ambition? Through which lens am I leading? And I started asking Eric questions like, can holy be comforting? Can holy be innocent? Can holy be beautiful? And can holy also be dark? Can holy be grimy? Can holy be disturbing? I mean, I started asking, you know, these questions like, I mean, what is sort of the anatomy of holiness? How do I, or how does anybody, or how does God perceive it? I mean, are there some components to holiness that are constant, or some forbidden? Can holy make us laugh? Can holy be transformative and freeing? But can holy also be feral and frightening? Can holy be uplifting? Can holy be offensive? I started thinking like, is understanding holier than feeling? Are weddings holier than funerals? Is belief holier than doubt? Is a smile holier than a scream? All these different questions, all getting at the root of, is holy the same as wholesome? And I know how I conclude that answer, but I'm not sure it's for me to conclude it for anybody else. But I do think that if people with a particular worldview think that those are the same always, and I think what that individual creates is going to reflect that. And I have had to work through a lot of guilt and shame over the types of stories, some of the types of stories that I find a lot of life in telling, because I thought I was doing something awful. And the last number of years for me have been a hard process of sort of getting disentangled from a lot of what I would call unnecessary shame over those types of stories that move me, and that I think, or at least I hope, move other people when I tell them.
I mean, you know, when you talk about it and when you explain it in that way, you know, the big question is as you make decisions as the writer or as the poet or as the artist, you know, creating, it is making those decisions internally. What might be some of those external things that you might say, hey, here's the impact of this, you know, even though this might be okay, but the impact of this or the impact of this, it might just take it too far? Or what in a sense, I mean, it is that great, great place. I mean, I'm a big fan of certain, you know, shows, mm-hmm. you know, that can be at times. And I think even the writers and producers have even said, you know, what our purpose is to make this gratuitous. Mm-hmm. So where's that fine line of saying, you know what, here is life and here is the depth and here is the meaning, and here is the complexities of it all. But yet in some ways on the safe side of things, you get wholesomeness. But then on the other side of things, you just get the gratuitous nature of like, this is just overindulgent.
Yeah. And, I mean, the answer is I have no idea. And I don't think, in all my thoughts on that, I think anytime we are seeking to, kind of have a permanent hard and fast rule when it comes to those things, I think robs us of the growth of having to consider it each time. And I think in the same way that anytime, you know, well, I mean, if I were to put it in like a New Testament sense, I think there's a reason why there's something more powerful about walking around with Jesus than there is about just reading laws on a piece of parchment. And I think it's because when you walk around with Jesus, you see how there's a lot of nuance. He goes, yeah, you're not supposed to do this on the Sabbath, but yeah, you should rest on the Sabbath, but it doesn't always mean that. It doesn't always mean this. And so to me, so much of the growth and transformation in my own life when it comes to the creative process is tangling with these things each time along the way, as opposed to just going, this word is wrong all the time, or this is wrong all the time. You go, well, I don't find that to be true when it pertains to storytelling. And I find that to be an easy way out. It doesn't actually push the creator to grow, and therefore I'm not sure it really is the best way to love an audience through a creative process. And you know, it's tough because it's interesting, Eric, even the way you phrase the question, and I find this is often the way that question is phrased to me. We have a fear of going too far, right? Like I remember like the sex talks when I was young, and how far is too far, and how, you know, whatever. And it's not that I don't think there's value in that question, but like when it comes to the creative process, I think the question we don't ask enough is not just when is too far, but when have we not gone far enough? Like when are we so fearful of crossing a line that we stop 200 yards short of it in a creative process? And in doing that, we tell stories that are sort of castrated of their essence and their power. And you know, I mean, going back to like the story, like some of this stuff you read in the Old or New Testament, I don't see that. I don't see stories that stop short. I don't see a story that goes, well, these daughters were lonely and it got really bad for a while. And no, it's like, here's what happened. This is what it is. And so to me, there's a, I don't want to make mistakes of going too far, but I also don't want to make mistakes of not going far enough. And somewhere in that line is that strange, you know, area in which we get to play, and we have and freedom to make mistakes, and making mistakes is okay. And then you say, hey, I think I probably went too far that time, and okay, come back and figure it out the next time. You just got to get back up on the bike. But if we're always making the mistake by not going far enough, I think that indicates something in me that I think needs some investigation.
It's, you know, it is that interesting place of just even having conversations about, you know, writing recently with some people in the sense of, you know, I can't do this, I can't do that. And I think there is this interesting thing about wholesomeness and holiness. And I wonder even the cultural contrast of even how some of the language, you know, or some of the topics or some of the issues because of cultural movements, whatever it might be, whether it be on the conservative side or liberal side, where we've kind of whitewashed things, or we've kind of simplified things and taken out the intense complexity of life and of joy as well as pain.
And Eric, if I can jump in there, I would say too, I have found in my life that and when I observe the landscape, sometimes I think we also do a great injustice to what sorts of works can teach, inspire, and move us. I mean, in the same way to say, well, if something isn't family friendly or whatever language someone might use, to say that's not holy. Well, to me, what the subtext of that has no power to really electrify you as a human being, or to bring hope or love or to refine character in your life. I mean, by condemning it, we're essentially saying it cannot serve good. And like, I look at a story like, I mean, you just take a cliche example, like Romeo and Juliet. Tough to sell that as a wholesome story. Tough to sell that as let's go and you know, read that to a bunch of children, and for good reason. But that doesn't mean that a story like that doesn't say something profound about how much we ache for love, how much we maybe ache for loneliness, how we can make decisions that create so much tragedy in our life about families unable to overcome their differences over. Just the catastrophic ramifications of envy and hatred. I mean, these are things that inform us powerfully, but that's not coming from a source that would probably be branded as wholesome. And so to me, I have had to continue to try to stretch myself beyond not just what I accept or condemn, but also to the point where I realize that some of the things I've probably in my past condemned probably have something very powerful to show me about life.
I love that Romeo and Juliet, you know, usage there, because I was just recently at home with multiple of my nieces and nephews, and they each, surprisingly at different grade levels, read it this year in school. And so, you know, sitting around the beach and having conversation about Romeo and Juliet, one loved it, one hated it, one was indifferent, you know, but the conversation about like, why would you kill yourself? Like, what is going on? And then I don't understand why these people can't get along. And, you know, it's so, it was really interesting then to sit with, you know, three teenagers in high school and have a unique conversation about William Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, and what that means. Even, you know, what he was writing about and what it even means in our lives.
Right. And those, and they, it poses difficult questions. you know, about despair and so on and so forth. And sometimes when I am only ingesting the things that perhaps are go down easily for me, then those probably aren't the things that are going to push me in areas that I need to be pushed.
So Josh, as we close up, I'm going to put you on the spot. See what you're ready for. Do you have a short poem or a short story that you could close us with?
Wow. Yeah, man. When you said on the spot, this was not like, this was not a joke. I was like, okay, I'll put you on the spot. What's the Bears record going to be this year? which would have been completely cool with me. Okay. All right. Short story or a poem? Short story or a poem? Okay. All right. I can do that for you. one second. Let me think. Well, all this will be edited out.
Of course not. No, we go with the pure unedited form and let
pure, people, okay.
Let
okay,
people,
gotcha.
Let
gotcha.
People a glimpse into life and into, you know, the thinking process. That's what I was like. You know, we're talking about creativity and, you know, let's just go right after it and see what you got for me today.
Okay, cool. I'll tell you a how about I read you a poem? Would that work?
Perfect.
I'll give you a poem. Okay. And this is in the spirit. This is definitely, let's say it's in the spirit of the conversation we've been having. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. This is called, I don't have it memorized, so I have to bring it up in front of me. I wish I had it memorized. Sadly, I do not. Okay, so this is called Matrimony. Okay. Last night, I could not sleep. My spirit was restless. My spirit was bleak. So I walked beneath the electric petticoat of stars to touch her private streets. Streets where heroes and junkies vomit vanity, where shuttered windows weep on abandoned asphalt feet. Streets where pretty and paladin and neophyte pauper, with sabers sheathed between rotted supernatural teeth, wring their braided hair of boredom and merrily scalp their own scalp to feel life's gushing rose garden realities hemorrhaging from their head. To squint as prism-eyed virgins at the sun, to inhale Hades through grandfather straw and sever the three hands of grandmother clock, to butcher monotonous noon while attempting to cure their catatonic brainwashed brains with paganism, patricide, incestuous puppets, and Poseidon. I touched her private street, where souls born into war copulate with war, breeding descendants of war, who dine on war and dance with war, and warm themselves under the cotton blanket bombs of war, who stroke aspergillum shotguns until they scatter holy water seed, and whose fetal choirs sing the everlasting anthem of cannons and Achilles, cannibalism, of coffee mixed with glycerin and milk, while Mary and Joseph are tailored for fatigue in order to combat the televised incursion of taxes and time, and the surgical table dissertations of terminal disease. I touched her private street, where creatures masquerading in sartorial class curtsy and kiss with manicured claws and manicured marrow, manicured minds lobotomized with corsages and diamond cufflinks, the metamorphosis of upper crust animals whose top hat dreams are wet for accountants and control, aristocracy, fur coat conformity, and checkbook beheading, for Canterbury beggars to be beckoned to black tie balls, the three rings of Barnum, then bloodied, disemboweled, and slurped from crystal bowls, all for the sake of Wall Street stigmata, induction onto divine red carpet, divine radio, and divine TV, into divine Oval Office, divine penthouse, divine dandelion Adonis, and divine green currency seed, smoking crucifixion cigars and capitalism and lavish cuisine, when all they ever wanted was a habitat of mud. I touched her private streets, where children, scaled, split-tongued surrogates, crawl on bloated denim bellies, boisterous cobras who shed their skin like Lazarus, slithering over candy and holidays, nightmares, nightgowns over colleges like castles, admitting only white knights, through burning alphabet forests and fondled farms of bliss, across cold mountains of nonsense to be baptized in ponds of piss, up nitrogen, knickknacks, and Lilliputian heads, over neon wombs and Newmans aborted on placenta post beds, beds of warmth, beds of escape, beds of cereal and ecumenical rape, beds made of scripture, beds made of brick, beds of uncle's expectations and the prescience of Charlie Dick, beds of albatross dad and alibi drink and alibi drug and alibi Bible, beds of a million serpents sodomized by Medusa, beds where pillows are stuffed black with dead feathers and lungs choke on the soot of artificial fear, and quilts are gnawed and quilts are sweaty and quilts are pulled apart, pulled teeth, pulled away, pulled to grief, to cross my hands and darken in Valhalla's tomb of sleep. Dewey Fields, please, decomposing compass free, will I ever reconcile with the sky? I touched her private streets, waking purgatory where tomorrow weeps. Be virtuous stars, deny my advance, make chaste your skirt. I've touched her all over, been touched, seen too much. The cruelest lover I ever had.
Thank you, Josh.
You're welcome. You're welcome.